Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Morgantown Community Church, especially if you're joining us for the first time. We're thrilled you're here. My name is Josh. I'm one of the pastors here. And I know there are several people watching us on Facebook Live this morning, folks who are on vacations at the beach, and so we're trying not to be resentful, and we want to welcome them from their paradise that they're in. But we've had great weather here the last day or so, haven't we? It's been super, super nice, and we are in a series right now on words, and it's about the power of words, and we're talking about sticks and stones. And of course, we all grew up with that sort of rhyme or whatever you would call it. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. And the only person who's ever said that is a person who's never been affected by somebody else's words, because the thing we've been exploring in the series is that actually words have a lot of power and words have a lot of potential. They can build up, they can inspire, they can comfort, they can heal, or they can tear down and discourage and wound and leave scars. And so we want to wrestle with how we're using words. And we've talked about maybe the most important thing to think about is we've talked about how words, actually between our, we think about how we speak and it involves air and vocal cords and the brain telling, but there's this reality that the heart, not like your actual heart, but the place inside of you where you exist, that part of you has a direct line to your tongue. And Jesus actually says that it's from the overflow of the heart that we say the things we say in the world. Or we tweet the things we tweet, or we Facebook the things we Facebook, right? It's from the overflow of the heart. So actually, we're not just in this series trying to deal with our tongue and our words and our speech. We're trying to get at the layer behind that, which is how do we work on our interior life? How do we work on our hearts so that the things that come out are actually helpful and good and beautiful things in the world? So today we're going to look at a passage in Ephesians chapter 4, and I've asked Jennifer Davis to come up and read this because you guys hear me read the Bible all the time, and so I figure sometimes it's good to hear other people read the Bible as well. So we're going to be in, and if you want to follow along, we're going to be in Ephesians chapter 4. We're going to do 17 through 32. So Jen, whenever you're ready, take it away.
So I'm telling you this, and I insist on it in the Lord. You shouldn't live your life like the Gentiles anymore. They base their lives on pointless thinking, and they are in the dark in their reasoning. They are disconnected from God's life because of their ignorance and their closed hearts. They are people who lack all sense of right and wrong, and who have turned themselves over to doing whatever feels good and to practicing every sort of corruption along with greed. But you didn't learn that sort of thing from Christ. Since you really listened to him, and you were taught how the truth is in Jesus, change the former way of life that was part of the person you once were, corrupted by deceitful desires. Instead, renew the thinking in your mind by the Spirit and clothe yourself with a new person created according to God's image in justice and true holiness. Therefore, after you have gotten rid of lying, each of you must tell the truth to your neighbor, because we are parts of each other in the same body. Be angry without sinning. Don't let the sun set on your anger. Don't provide an opportunity for the devil. Thieves should no longer steal. Instead, they should go to work, using their hands to do good so that they will have something to share with whoever is in need. Don't let any foul words come out of your mouth. Only say what is helpful when it is needed for building up the community so that it benefits those who hear what you say. Don't make the Holy Spirit of God unhappy. You are sealed by him for the day of redemption. Put aside all bitterness, losing your temper, anger, shouting, and slander, along with every other evil. Be kind, compassionate, and forgiving to each other in the same way God forgave you in Christ.
One of those, that's one of those passages that if you're breathing, there's probably something in there for us, right? Where this writer who wrote this letter to this church is essentially talking about two ways of living. And he begins this conversation, and I find it really interesting. He begins this conversation by saying, I'm telling you, and I insist on it, Lord, you shouldn't live your life like the Gentiles anymore. And this seems sort of like a barb at Gentiles, right? Because they're the problem. But you have to understand, in this pastor's worldview, there are two groups of people. There are Jewish people, and then there's everybody else. And so the word gets translated Gentiles here. It really is just a way of saying the 99% of the world lives a certain way. And it's a certain way that actually is unhelpful, and it's untransformed, and there's all sorts of things that need to happen to it, right? So the writer begins by saying, I insist that you should think differently and live differently in the world. Now, what I find interesting about this is he describes this Gentile mindset, and it's characterized by selfishness, right? He talks about sort of this idea that it's all about them. It's has a lack of restraint. And I think in our speech is one of those places where this, and I'll just tell you in my own life, I come up with some really great one-liners, especially when I'm aggravated at somebody. Whoa, did you see that right there? I come up with some really good one-liners. And there, I mean, it's sometimes it's really, really good, and I'm really proud of myself. But then when you see how it affects another person's life, the thing that was funny to you may have been devastating to another person, right? So there's this sense of lack of restraint. And this us-them sort of thinking, right? We tend to be tribal as a culture. We know who the good guys are because we're the good guys. We know who the bad guys are because they're not us, right? We know who's right, us. We know who's wrong, everybody else. And there tends to be this way of thinking in the world that actually doesn't make the world better, where we just sort of carve it up and we all have our turf and our territory. And he says, this is that way of thinking. And it's actually closed. It's actually a closed-minded way of thinking. There are two ways to be closed-minded, right? You can be religiously closed-minded and think that you have all the answers and nobody else has anything to contribute and there's nothing left to learn. That's one way. I've been that way. But you can also be closed-minded in another way of saying, you know what? Nothing about that is worth hearing. Nothing about that, right? It's not just a closed-mindedness is not just a religious people problem. It is a human problem when we actually begin to believe that we have all the answers, whether we're religious or non-religious or Baptist or Catholic or Methodist or whatever. Like when we believe we have all the answers, we shut off a part of our brain that actually is open to new things, new thoughts, new actions, new activities. And so the writer's getting into that. The thing I want to focus on today, and I want to kind of create some conversation at the end around this, is he actually says, this is not what you learned from Christ, and you learned a different way of being from Christ. And I love this language where he basically says, Jesus calls us to a different kind of paradigm, a different way of seeing the world, and a different way of being in community together. I think the most, probably the most depressing, painful thing for a person is to come into a community of faith and expect to be treated one way, expect to be welcomed, expect to be cared for, expecting to be loved. And in the community of faith where they expect those things, it's actually just like everybody else. How many of you have ever been a part of a religious community that was just like middle school? Right? Man, I so desperately want to be able to tell my children, middle school only lasts a few years, and then you go, and it's not the same way. But high school is like middle school, and grown-ups are like middle school, right? I mean, there's just this tendency, and in a faith community, people come in expecting to be loved and accepted. And I can't tell you the number of messages I get through email or on Facebook where somebody says, I found your community on the internet. I listened to your sermons. I watched The Gathering online. I think this is exactly the kind of church I'm looking for. I just have one question. Would I be welcome? And then they list a bunch of reasons why religious people have told them they wouldn't be welcome before. Right? And the writer here says, no. There is a different way. Jesus invites us to a different way of creating community, where we create community where everybody has a seat at the table and everybody's accepted and everybody's loved, regardless of what their position is on this issue or this issue or this issue. Like, it's something larger. And he says, Jesus asks us, invites us, calls us, challenges us to adopt a new paradigm. And he actually uses some really, I think, helpful, beautiful language about this. This is what Jesus says to his disciples. He calls them over and he says, and by the way, they've been in a debate about who's the greatest, right? I mean, isn't this great? Like, who is the best disciple of Jesus? And I remember growing up and going to Sunday school as a kid, and like when you memorize the Bible verses, you would get like a button to wear. And so I loved wearing that button because it meant I was more religiously holy than everybody. You know what I mean? Like that sort of attitude, right? Where it's like, hey, look at me. I know more Bible verses with which to club people about the head and shoulders than everybody else does. And Jesus actually says, look, there's a way of ordering the world that tends to be divisive, and it tends to be there are people on top and there are people on the bottom, and the people on top, you know, are the people on top and they let everybody know it, and the people on the bottom really don't count. Well, here's what Jesus says. You know, the ones who are considered the rulers by the Gentiles show off their authority over them, and their high-ranking officials order them around. They essentially, people on top boss around people on the bottom, right? Has the world changed a lot in a couple thousand years? It's really kind of the same place, isn't it? People on top order around the people at the bottom. And I think we've all probably experienced religious communities or religious situations where this is the case, right? You have a pastor, you have some leaders, and they boss around everybody else. And Jesus actually says, that's not the way it will be with you. You're not going to order your community the way the rest of the world orders its community. And he says, Whoever wants to be great among you will be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you will be the slave of all. For the human one didn't come to be served, but rather to serve and to give his life to liberate many people. And there's actually a beautiful scene in the Gospel of John where Jesus enacts this by taking on the garments of a servant and he washes his disciples' feet, right? As a way of saying to them, by the way, this is one of those things that I really do mean literally. I don't mean this to just be sort of like a nice thing you think about. I want you to actually be the servant of everyone. Jesus says, here's how the world gets ordered. This is how the world behaves with this power and this divisiveness in your community. It's actually going to be the leaders will be the people who serve. The leaders will be the people who are open to loving and embracing everyone, regardless of their station or stature in the outside world. And when the writer of Ephesians talks about this, he uses this word, clothe yourself with a new person created according to God's image in justice and true holiness. I love that idea, clothe yourself, which has this idea of, you know, they say everybody puts their pants on the same way, right? One leg at a time, right? Have you ever tried to do that the opposite way and just jump into them so you can prove that wrong? It doesn't go well, does it? And there's this sense, I love this idea of clothes because it's about putting something on. It's something you didn't have on before, and now you're making this intentional decision to begin putting on a certain way of being. Now, if that image doesn't work for you, here's a couple other ways to think about this. So you could think about it as putting on new kinds of clothes. You could think of what he's saying is put on new kinds of lenses. We actually just had our son and the optometrist for his every year they go and check them before a new school year. And we're talking about new lenses and those sorts of things. What do new lenses do? Well, when you first put them on, like I know every time I get a new lens prescription, I put them on the first day or so, I feel sick. Does anybody else do this? Because it's not the same. And it's my brain and my eyes are adjusting to a new way of seeing that will eventually be a better way of seeing. But on the front end, it's actually quite frustrating. And I think this is a great way of thinking about what Jesus invited. Like things we're going to be invited to think about here in a bit aren't things that at first aren't things that are going to be really, really easy. And they're not things that it's going to be tough. I mean, if you've ever tried loving somebody who doesn't love you, if you've ever tried being kind to somebody who's mean, like you know this, it is not easy. And so maybe you could think about it like this. It's about getting a new pair of lenses and learning to see your world and your life through a different set of lenses. And everybody has lenses, by the way. Even if you have 20/20 vision, you have a lens called a worldview. And that's what you see the world through. And that's what you make decisions about people through. And that's how you decide who's good and who's bad and who's loved and who's unloved. Like we have these lenses and we're essentially being invited to pay attention to them. And it may be that the reason we don't see the world really well is because our lenses are scratched up and smudged and they have fingerprints all over them. And we need to either clean them or we may just need to throw the old ones away and get a new pair, right? So think about it like lenses. Maybe you think about it like this if you're a computer person, and I know just enough about computers to mess them up and have to call somebody to fix it, but think about a new operating system. This past week, I have a MacBook, and because that's what Jesus would use, and I have this MacBook, and I hadn't updated the software in forever, and so basically my computer was in protest. And it's like, I'm not doing anything until you download this. And so one morning I come in and I guess Wednesday morning, we had been off for the holiday and I come in and I say, okay, we're going to do this today because I need to use all my programs. And it tells me, and I think the computer was just angry. It tells me this will take 28 minutes. And like an hour and a half later, it still said 28 minutes. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've destroyed it. But eventually it rebooted. And it had brand new desktop background, which was kind of nice and majestic. And I look around and my programs work now because they were trying to run on an old operating system and they just wouldn't run anymore. And I think this is a great way to think about what we're being invited to is essentially the writer saying we need to download a new operating system because the kind of things that need to happen in our lives cannot happen on the old system. The old way of thinking, the old way of being, the old way of treating people, the old way of carving up the world will not work in this new thing called the kingdom that God is inviting you to. So we need an upgrade, and we need to be willing. And, you know, just like it takes a while to download software, it takes a while to download this new software. And there are times when you'll begin to operate on the old system, right? But perhaps that's a way of thinking about it. And then another way is think about a spirit transplant. Anybody watch I almost said ER, which when did that go off the air? Like 1998? or any of those medical shows. Anybody watch those things? And it's not real, right? It's not real, but they have enough stuff in there that seems real. And when something's happening and there's a transplant going on, you're just leaning forward, wondering how it's going to work out. And you totally forget that these people are acting right now and this is not real. And there's something powerful about somebody who needs a heart. Somebody else gives them a heart and now they can live their lives. In this way, we're being invited to a spirit transplant, right? We're being invited to receive a different spirit, a spirit that will enable us to live more fully, more freely, more generously, more kindly, more compassionately, right? And it takes a while. When you receive this transplant, your body wants to reject it, right? Because there are certain moments when it's just easier to do the old thing. But the writer's saying, actually, no. We are called to live and be differently than we have been in the past. And so the text, and you heard this when Jen read it, the text goes through this. There's an old way, and then there's this new thing you're being invited to. So I want to spend some time just looking at the old way versus the new way and what we're being invited to. The old way is not truthful, right? And you can use speech to be not truthful with people, can't you? And you can say things that, I mean, how many of you have ever been pulled over and you told a slight lie just to, right? I didn't know how fast I was going. Come on. Right? How many of you have ever been in the middle of something and you've told something maybe to one of your children just to get them to whatever, and you told them something that may or may not have actually been true, right? And so why do we tell things that aren't true? We tell things that aren't true because we want people to think something about us, or we want people to do something that we want them to do. And when we tell things that aren't true, we're essentially saying to people, I want you to think something about me, but I don't want to actually become the kind of person who would do that thing. I just want you to think I am. Right? And so the writer says, actually, let's actually become the kinds of people so that we can be honest about ourselves. We can be honest about when we say something, people can trust it. And then he says this a little earlier in the chapter, speaking the truth in love. Speaking the truth in love. How many of you ever heard that phrase before? How many of you have ever heard that phrase from somebody who said, now, I'm just going to speak the truth in love, and then there wasn't an ounce of love in what they said after that? I'm going to speak the truth in love. It's like when somebody says to you, I mean no disrespect, or don't take this the wrong way, but you're an idiot, right? Like, well, how many ways are there to take that, right? You just called me an idiot. I don't think there's a right way to call somebody an idiot. And so when he says speak the truth in love, I think he means this. Love is when you value another person, like when you see this person and you actually value their feelings at the moment even more than your own, right? And what you're doing. So there are times when speaking the truth in love can actually be very painful. If you have somebody in your life you've ever experienced with addiction, saying to this person, you are going down the wrong path and it's dark and it's ugly and you're taking your friends and family with you. Like you have to say something, right? And it may not be pretty, but it comes from a place of love. And what we often do is I'm going to speak the truth in love and say the most harsh, mean thing we could ever think of saying. He's saying, no, actually, when you speak the truth to people, care enough about them to say things that are going to be helpful, that are encouraging, that are hopeful, that call them to be their best selves. I think part of the reason, you guys have heard about Facebook by now, right? You know about Facebook, like it's a thing. And I sometimes think we go on there and we don't say things that call people to being their best selves. And what would it look like if our speech to one another was calling each and every one of us to the best? Now, that sometimes that may mean pushing back on some attitudes that are ugly and nasty, right? But at the same time, for example, if you hear somebody say something racist, what's the right thing to do? I'll tell you the thing I can't do is ignore it. I can't ignore it. But what if instead of just attacking the person, what if our goal was, gosh, I would love for this person not to be a racist anymore. Do you see the difference in the approach? In one way, you just say whatever you want to get them back for what they said. In another way, you're trying to use your speech in love to try to bring that person into a better perspective. Right? So we're being invited to think about how we use our words truthfully. And then he talks about unresolved anger and resolved anger. Don't let the sun go down when you're angry. How many of you have ever gone to bed angry? You've been in a fight with your partner and you just go to bed. When we first got married, Carla could just go to sleep like that. Like we'd be in the middle of a fight, she's like, I'm going to bed. And it used to make me so angry because I couldn't. And I wanted to talk about it. She just wanted to go to sleep. And so I would actually quote this verse. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. But she's already asleep when I was quoting it, right? It fell on literally deaf ears. And I think there's something to be said, and I think obviously, sometimes you're going to go to bed in a fight. I think the larger picture is when you go to bed angry one night and you go to bed angry another night and you go to bed angry another night, suddenly this thing that could have been resolved and forgiven and reconciled is now this thing that is growing between you. And that's true for people in relationships. That's also true for friendships, all sorts of ways. When you have something unresolved and you just keep going to bed with it and you keep waking up with it and you carry it around, it's almost like a little animal inside you that you're feeding, right? And you're just keeping it alive. You're just getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And he says, look, this creates space for the adversary. And we talked about that in Romans 16 a few weeks in our last series. But it gives space for something to grow that shouldn't be there. Something that's not helpful, something that's not healing, something that actually can make the world worse. And so he says, you actually have to resolve your anger. And not in the way where you just sweep it under the rug, right? But where you actually have a conversation and you say things in love to one another and you actually begin to figure out what's the problem and move forward. And then he talks about stealing, from moving from stealing to finding employment and then generously giving to others. You see, and I think this is a great picture of the transformation. You go from a human being who's taking to a human being who's taking without regard for the people you're taking it from, to a human being who's seeking to contribute. And there's something powerful in a relationship about saying, it's not just about me taking, it's about me also contributing. And then he talks about foul words. Do you remember the first time you ever heard or said a curse word? Do you remember that when you were a kid? I remember the first time I ever did. It's because in 1984, my parents bought me this VHS tape, the first VHS tape I ever owned. It cost $30, which at the time I thought, we're millionaires. We can buy a $30 tape. It was Ghostbusters. Not the new Ghostbusters. The old Ghostbusters. How many of you love that movie? And you'll just admit it publicly right now. When I started kindergarten, I had memorized it. Every line. And I would act it out and play it while I was watching it. But there are some lines in there that aren't school appropriate. And I remember the first time I ever used profanity, it was at school quoting a line from Ghostbusters about showing this prehistoric woman how we do things downtown. And I just said this in the middle of, and the teacher was like, whoa, that's not a, we don't say that at school. And of course, you know, I'm sure my mom was mortified that I would ever say such a thing. But I remember that was, and when I think about foul words, the first thing that comes to my mind are some of those words you're not allowed to say in public, right? The words you say when you stub your toe, or the words you say. But here's the thing. That's not at all what's being talked about here. When we talk about words like that at our house, we say there are grown-up words. There are some bad words that are like words that demean people, words that attack people for being, you know, for what the color of their skin or who they love. We don't say those words. Then there are grown-up words, which you can decide whether or not you use them when you're a grown-up, if you understand the context. That's up to you. But he's not talking about grown-up words here. He's not talking about three-letter and four-letter words you can and can't use. The word here in original language is sapros, which comes from the word sepos, which is where we get our word septic. Now, what goes in the septic tank? Right? It's that kind of language. Which has nothing, it has everything to do, I think, with the intent of the words. You can use foul words that you can use in public, and they're still very foul because they wound, they demean, and they essentially make fun of people. You can use these kind of words, and it actually can seem very socially appropriate to use them, but they're actually demeaning to somebody else. He's saying, get rid of your potty mouth. Get rid of the trash talk. Get rid of the words you're saying that when you say them, you can see the light in somebody else's eyes just disappear because you said the thing that wounded them, right? Get rid of this sort of language. Get sort of these foul words in their place. And so we could actually translate it. Don't let any septic speech come out of your mouth. No septic speech. And he actually says, instead, replace that septic speech with words of encouragement, with words of hope, with words that bring life. It's possible to say hard things to people because you love them and to say it in a way that doesn't make them feel demeaned or misheard or they're unloved. We can find ways to do that. Don't speak any septic words. And then he says, get rid of bitterness. And bitterness is one of those things that it actually can be enjoyable in a way. Have you ever known somebody who's so miserable and bitter and they seem to love it? Like it's their default operating system. And sometimes it's just, you remember that Tim McGraw song, Why You Gotta Be Angry All the Time? Like, there are people you just want to say, like, why you gotta be mad? Like, why can't we just be cool? But there are sometimes people who have, their operating system is now one of bitterness, and they're being invited to trade that and losing their temper and anger and shouting and slander. Have you ever seen a grown-up look like a toddler losing their temper? And you think, if you could see how silly you look right now, you would never do this. But then when it's you, you're totally justified because you, right? When other people do it, we totally see it. Like, losing your cool like that, it's just completely ridiculous. Anger, shouting, and slander. Instead, be kind, be compassionate, and forgiving. And he gives us this, forgive in this way, as God has forgiven you in Christ. What is God's forgiveness like? The amazing thing about forgiveness in my book is that everybody has it, whether they know it or not. Right? Forgiveness isn't a thing that you don't have. It's a thing you either know you have or you don't know you have. And when you know you have it, you begin to live differently because of it. And we're being told the same grace that you receive from God, which is not something you can earn or get because you do the right thing or believe the right thing, it's yours, is the same grace that you are called to extend to others. Now, I do believe there are some people who we need to extend grace to from a different zip code. Right? There are toxic people who keeping them in your orbit is toxic to you and your family and your friends and your life. And so there's some people we need to say, for me to love you and forgive you, I need you to move like to Antarctica. And I will pay your airfare. Right? There are some people we need to keep space from. And yet, it's possible to keep space and not nurse bitterness and anger and resentment. And I say this not as somebody who's done a perfect job at doing that, but I know the other side of it. I know what it's like to hold bitterness and anger and resentment towards someone. And that's very destructive, and it shrinks your spirit in a way that you just aren't living the full life. So he says, look, ultimately, in a community like this, your default mode with each other should be one of understanding, compassion, kindness, and forgiveness. Where you're quick to forgive, not quick to be angry. Where you give each other the benefit of the doubt, where you know in a community like this, we love one another and we're coming. We may disagree on things. And I think this is when you really love somebody and you really trust that relationship, that's when you can really fight. You know what I mean? Like there are times when I'll say something to a close friend in anger that I would have never said to somebody else because I know that that person is going to forgive me and they're going to have my back, right? There's something about knowing. And so I can give you my opinion on something and you may disagree with it and we're still going to be okay, right? You may say something and I disagree with it and we're still going to be okay. That's what this community is invited to become. And to sum up this section, I want to hear from you guys. I think the point of the Christian path, what we're being told here, the point of the Christian path is transformation. Like, that's the point of it. It's not evacuation. It's not taking you somewhere else and out of this world. The point of the Christian path is transformation. And it begins internally. Now, when I was younger, I thought it began externally. So you had to look the part. And if you'd have seen me in the early 90s, I had WWJD everywhere, right? I had bracelets, I had t-shirts, I had socks. And I really, really wanted people to know I'm doing what Jesus would do. It doesn't begin externally. It begins internally. When you and I open our hearts and we say, I want this new operating system. I want this spirit transplant. I want to experience this new life. I want to be open to that ongoing transformation that we're being invited to here. So with that, let's open it up for a few minutes and see if anybody has anything. And no, if this is your first time here, we don't demand participation. We just like to give space for people to share. Walter.
G20.
Okay. But anyway, he made some remarks, and I knew how they would be taken. So as I scrolled down and read some of the responses to the article and his words, I wasn't at all surprised. But what I found by this poll is so courageous and brave that He speaks wisdom and truth, even though he knows, I'm sure he knew the response that he would get. But what he was saying was to me is that he called names, he named names, countries, who have a distorted view of the world. Now, if that hits home, rather than chastising and berating him and calling him bad names, why couldn't we take these words and reboot or change our operating system?
Because if you live long enough, somebody's going to say something in critique of your life, and they're going to be right. I like to think every time somebody says something negative about me, well, they don't know me. No, actually, sometimes they're right, right? Sometimes I've got things to work on. So I think if you live long enough, somebody's going to speak truth into your life, and you're not going to be like, oh, thank you so much. But at some point, you might, if it's done in love. The other thing about that is people always say that they want a preacher, a pastor, who doesn't just tell them what they want to hear. But the minute that preacher or pastor says something they dislike, what do? They start making a cross to crucify them on, right? And so the reality is, if you really don't want to be told what you just want to hear, then you have to be open to sometimes leaving church and being frustrated or disagreeing or whatever, because that's supposed to happen, right? We're supposed to be saying things that push and challenge. So that's a great, great point. I like this Pope a lot, Papa Frank. Yeah.
And I think that is, it helps me be able to speak and stand up for myself, but yet see them in a different way, whoever it is.
You know, it's a sad day for us as grown-ups. And I think if you've paid attention to both sides of the political debate in the past several years, we no longer can just say, I disagree with that idea, and here's why. We say, the person holding that idea is an idiot, and they don't know anything. And what are we teaching our kids? I mean, there are things I hear our elected officials and other adults saying that I thought, if my kid said that, he'd be grounded for a week and a half. And yet here we are as adults, we're in the world teaching our children that actually going after somebody's intelligence is the first thing you do, or making fun of them or calling them names. And I think this idea of saying the thing that needs to be said, as you mentioned, but doing so recognizing that this is a beloved human being in the image of God, and how would I want them to say this to me if I was in the other way around, which is the whole do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's so good. Yep. Anybody else? Yes, Cheryl. You just need to preach one Sunday. That is a thing that needs to happen. You just need to preach because you are on fire. Seriously, that is so good. And I think there is this sense of a lot of what we say is it ends up being trying. Richard Rohr, you know Richard Rohr. He said something like this. I've said this before, I think, but there is nothing to prove. There is nothing to defend. I am who I am, and it's enough. And when you own that identity, that's how God sees. Like, you are God's beloved child. We all have some growing up to do, right? But at the same time, there is nothing to prove. And imagine what we would live like if we actually knew that were true. So good. So here's what we're going to... Yes, Brenda.
In the prophet, Gibran says, you talk when you cease to be at peace with your thoughts.
Ooh. Can I repeat that real quick? You talk when you cease to be at peace with your thoughts.
And I mean, I realize we do that, or I do it sometimes when I'm just meeting people and you just kind of rattle on and, you know. And another thing that has made a real difference in my life, and I used to write it on everything, and it's from Confucius, it said that all antagonisms are complementary.
All antagonisms are complementary?
Yes.
It's so hard to live that way, isn't it? I mean, we want to come out swinging, and yet we're being invited to this whole non-anxious, non-violent. Oh, it's beautiful. I think we should just eventually, one week, just pass the mic around and let all y'all preach. Is that good? So here's what we're going to do today as we wrap this up. We're going to do two things, and we're going to do two things because I think they are the best examples of what this path, in ritual, they're the best examples of what this path looks like. We're going to celebrate communion, Eucharist, here in a moment, which is where we take bread and we dip it in a cup. It's a reminder of Jesus' body broken and blood poured. And it's also a reminder that this is the path that all of us are called to. Jesus actually says, I've got a cross. And he says to his disciples, now you get yours. Right? So Eucharist is not just a remembrance of Jesus. It's an invitation into this path of being broken open and poured out like Jesus. And then the other thing we're going to do is we're going to celebrate baptism. Because it's this beautiful symbol of this new life. Of this new operating system being beginning to download, this new set of lenses being put on. So that's how we're going to wrap up today. I'm going to offer a prayer, and then the band is going to play, and you're going to be invited to go celebrate communion if you'd like to. Everybody's welcome here. Doesn't matter if you go here. Like, everybody's welcome here. If you want to participate, we'd love for you to do that. And so I'm going to say a prayer, and then we'll have some people in the back with communion, and you are welcome to meet the risen Christ and one another at that table. Let's pray. God, we are grateful for this invitation into a new way of being, a new way of seeing, a new way of living, a new way of interacting with one another. And while we're so unbelievably thrilled with the invitation, we also recognize that it's not easy, that letting go of one way of seeing, it can be very difficult, that putting on new glasses can, at the beginning, feel very uncertain. That it's great to have that new operating system, but it takes forever sometimes to download. And so give us patience. May we know that you are patient with us, and that our two steps forward and one step back do not diminish your love for us, that you are patient, and that your concern for us is not how quick we get there, but that we get there. So open our hearts. May we meet the risen Christ in this bread and in this cup. May we meet one another there. And may we open ourselves to the calling you have given us to be the hands and feet of Jesus in the world, to extend the love of God to everyone we meet. We're grateful for this body broken and blood poured and for this invitation to do the same. We ask this in Jesus' name, and everybody said, amen. You're welcome to go whenever you're ready.